name's Amy and I'm a clinical psychologist with the Northwest Counterterrorism Unit. My role here is to help people understand why people engage in the behaviours and activities that they do. And that can be anything from helping people to understand how we might better examine what somebody's thinking about doing or going to do or has actually done, how can we understand that better. It might be advising on how to interview somebody. It might be looking at whether somebody's vulnerable or not, how we can intervene. So I work from everything from the prevent end of the spectrum, so people who are vulnerable to radicalisation, all the way up to live investigations.
We hear that word sort of spouted out quite a lot, radicalisation. Yeah. How would you explain it? What is it exactly?
So radicalisation, I suppose, the way we see it here is it's where somebody has adopted an extreme set of beliefs, and we don't consider that if somebody has an extreme set of beliefs that we therefore have to act, because lots of people have beliefs that we may or may not agree with. We're worried about people that perhaps do think that they should act on those beliefs. So it's people who have formed an opinion about something and they feel that they should do something about it. So within the prevent arena, we look at, can we help people to find ways of expressing their beliefs or understanding their beliefs better in a pro-social way? And if we feel that somebody's at risk of acting on those beliefs in a criminal way or a less pro-social way, then can we intervene at some point to stop that from happening? So radicalisation, I suppose you could also see it in parallel to people who are gang members. People who join gangs are very much affiliated to the members of the gang. To other people within that gang, they form a very close sense of community and sense of identity, and they will very much see themselves as part of a particular group. So one group against another group, you could almost say that you could see that in football teams. If you join Man United, then you don't really like Man City fans. If you're a member of Manchester City, you don't really like Manchester United fans. And we've seen through history where rival gangs of football fans will attack each other simply for the group that they're in. So radicalisation, I think we quite often see as quite a complex process, but actually in terms of a psychological behaviour, a psychological understanding of that behaviour, actually we all try and find somewhere that gives us a sense of identity, a sense of belonging, a sense of community, somewhere where we have shared views and beliefs, people who are alongside us who think the same thing. The differences, I guess, within the world of counterterrorism, and we're looking at people who then may move on to act quite violently in response to those beliefs.
Looking at sort of radicalisation within terrorism,
yeah.
Is there a certain age that tends to be more vulnerable to it, or is it across the spectrum completely?
We tend to see more younger people, because the younger you are, the more you're searching to find where does your identity sit, what's important to you, what are your values, what are your beliefs. So young people are probably much more likely to be radicalised and be more open to somebody presenting them with something that sounds quite compelling. If you're 16 to 19 years old and somebody presents you with this, what can be seen these days is quite a glamorous thing to do, to be on Twitter communicating with members of Islamic State, people are drawn to that. And if you use my football analogy, if you just follow Manchester United on Twitter, you're not going to necessarily feel part of that. If you were to get engagement from one of the players, that would be much more enticing and much more compelling. And it's the same thing in radicalisation, and they're drawn to something that sounds quite exciting, that sounds quite different, that takes them away from the norm of schoolwork, homework, doing what their parents tell them. So we certainly see younger people are more likely to be radicalised, but we do get the anomalies where people are in their 20s, 30s, so we may also see that, but I think the bulk of our work around people who are vulnerable is in the teenage, early 20s stage.
Do you think that age group's targeted for that reason then?
I don't know whether targeted's the right word. I suppose there's a dynamic going on whereby, I mean, we see a lot of it now, and a lot of the reporting in the media is about the use of social media and Twitter and those kinds of things. So young people are on social media networks and forums. They're on Facebook, they're on Twitter, they're on Snapchat. That's where people who are looking to radicalise are also on.
You mentioned obviously the age group as well, 16 to say early 20s, but yeah. Are you seeing the age getting younger of those being radicalised? I mean, how young are we talking?
We've seen 14-year-olds. Certainly over the last couple of years, we've seen a decrease in the age that's got access to the internet anyway, because of the advent of smartphones, everybody's got one. So in terms of parents being able to police that, that's become much more difficult anyway. But certainly, yeah, there's 14-year-olds we're aware of that have been vulnerable to being radicalised, and certainly trying to engage in social media forums with people who may put them at risk.
Why do people become radicalised?
Million-dollar question. Why do people become radicalised? I suppose because they are searching for somewhere where they can find meaning. And that's not something that we should be seeing as an unusual behaviour. We all seek a career that means something to us. We all seek something out that gives us a sense of purpose in our day, that gives us a sense of status. So it's not about necessarily wanting to be at the top of your profession, but it's about somewhere where you feel you belong and that you've got respect and people alongside you that are similar to you. I think the radicalisation side of it is more about whether we move somebody towards acting. And I think because we've got at the moment quite excessive media reporting. And I don't mean that in that there's too much of it, but actually a lot of what's being reported is around Syria, the refugee crisis, what's happening to historic sites, people travelling, whole families going. There's actually a constant narrative available to people that I think we're seeing more and more people becoming radicalised, potentially because people feel more inclined to put themselves on one side of the camp or the other. And I think one of the errors we sometimes make is we try and propose too much of... There's a lot of talk around counter-narratives. So we say to people, what IS are doing is wrong. If you believe something to be right, and I say the complete opposite, you're more likely to entrench your position. We all do that. If you really like one of your friends, for example, and I say I can't stand them, you're more likely to defend them. If I say to you, I can see why you like them, but sometimes they irritate me, sometimes I find them a bit unreliable, you're more likely to come over to my point of view. We're more likely to meet in the middle. And one of the errors we're making, I think, is that people are saying, I support IS, I support what's happening, and we say, well, you shouldn't. It's wrong. We entrench people further. So actually we could end up radicalising somebody more than they were in the first place by taking completely the opposite end of the spectrum. So there's no real answer as to why people become radicalised, because there's such a whole host of reasons. But there's a complex mix of not having an idea of where they belong, not having a clear sense of status, but also being subject to a lot of media bombardment of do you agree or do you disagree, and people coming in at extra... We almost present the other extreme by saying you shouldn't support it. So we have to be careful around that as well. I think challenging someone's belief doesn't necessarily have to be directly done on a one-to-one basis. It's exposing people to alternative interpretations, because until they're at a stage of actually kind of wanting to move into action, they're still open to hear alternative interpretations of an event. It's only when we're perhaps at an end of thinking somebody's literally going to do something that we need to start directly challenging that behaviour or intervening or disrupting it.
In terms of those that have become radicalised and they're at the extreme end of that radicalisation, how difficult is it to reverse that process?
It's difficult because in the same way that if anyone believes anything strongly, for you to say you shouldn't believe that and we need to send you back down another route is exceptionally difficult. But that's not to say that it's not possible. Again, it's about how you do it and through which methods that you do that. But for some people, the reality of the potential consequences were they to act is enough to send somebody in a different direction, because one of the things that you find is people, they will hold extreme beliefs, they will look into what they could do, and they may say things without actually ever intending to do it. So sometimes you can send somebody back down a pathway, perhaps by reminding them of the consequences. Other people will become aware of the impact on their families and friends and community, and that will be enough to make them think otherwise.
And those that do end up caught, arrested, charged, guilty, and then sent to prison, what work then takes place with that person to de-radicalise them?
Yeah, there are de-radicalisation programmes. We tend not to call them de-radicalisation because it's difficult to know what we actually mean if we say we're going to de-radicalise. Do we unradicalise you? Do we leave you with the belief and not the action? Because we could release somebody from prison who still holds those beliefs but has no intention to do anything about it. So we look at trying to help people to form what we call healthy identities in prison and to strengthen their positives and what we call protective factors whilst they're in prison. It's not necessarily a kind of manualised group intervention programme. It will probably be very much around one-to-one work, about understanding how somebody got to that point where they felt that their future was around attacking people on the basis of a belief, and can we somehow address that so that when they get released from prison they have a healthy way to proceed. Literature internationally around de-radicalisation programmes is not particularly positive at the moment, but I think that's because although we've had people acting for years, you know, we've had a terrorist threat for years, I don't think we've seen anything like we're seeing now. So there's a lot of work going on to see what does a de-radicalisation look like and how do we even measure its effective. Generally speaking, terrorists aren't repeat offenders. Our terrorist offenders are not repeat offenders. Obviously some are, and the names that people will know in the media, the ones that are reported all the time, people know that they remain kind of adhered to their own narrative. But a lot of what we also know is a lot of people are convicted of terrorism offences, they do their sentences and they don't offend again. So perhaps prison in itself is a deterrent, and going back to that, there's a consequence to behaviour. They may retain their extremist belief, but they may not ever wish to act on that. Over the next, I think, 2 to 3 years, we'll be much clearer on what a de-radicalisation programme looks like and how we best put that forward, and whether we need to do that within prisons or whether that needs to happen beforehand.
Is there a profile of a terrorist, or can it affect anybody?
There's no common profile of a terrorist. And I can never give somebody, I think psychologists often seem to do that, I'm going to give you a profile, and I can't do that in the world of terrorism. What we do know from the lone actor research that we do here is that we do know certain behaviours that people exhibit before they perhaps act. So we focus much more on what is somebody doing rather than who they are, because the danger is if we say they're normally between, I don't know, 20 and 30 and male and unemployed, that actually we miss a big tranche of people. We know from experience, as you mentioned, we've got from 14 up to, I think we've had up to 67, 70. And we've had people who are married, people who have got children, people who've got pregnant partners, people who are school teachers, people who are in good jobs. There is no profile in terms of character, demographic characteristics, which is why we focus much more on people's behaviour and what they're doing, because there are more commonalities within that than there are within a demographic description that wouldn't be particularly helpful to give.